sanction nor censure from Canada and its rule of law defending allies. Ken Stone is with the Syria Support Movement International and Hamilton Coalition to Stop the Wars. We spoke last in June about the European Union's 7th Brussels Conference on the Future of Syria and the Region, an annual event held without Syrian participation. And that was on the first day of summer past. Here we are at the end of summer, Ken. Before we get to talking about what's going on in what looks to me like a redux of a color revolution or the color revolution in Syria of 2011, Ken, I want to talk about an event that you and the Hamilton Coalition have coming up next week, billed as the world premiere of Peace, War, and 9/11, celebration of the life of Dr. Graham McQueen. Who, Ken, was Graham McQueen?
Graham was the founder of the Global Peace Studies Department at McMaster University, and he was the head of it for 3 decades, during which time he was a good ally of ours in opposing all the wars of the empire that took place. And it was a very sad day that in his retirement, just this past April 25th, he passed away due to cancer. And we weren't able, his friends, including us, weren't able to have a celebration of his life immediately following his death. So what transpired was that there happens to be a filmmaker, Ted Wright, and Paul MacArthur, who are putting on the premiere of the film Peace, War, and 9/11, which is about Graham's research, his post-retirement research into the manufactured war, as he calls it, specifically George W. Bush's war on terror, which, as we all know from past experience of the last 20 years, turned out to be a war of terror against the people of Central Asia, all the way to from Afghanistan through to North Africa, including Libya, an unmitigated disaster for the world in terms of destruction and death and the refugee crisis. And Graham shows the pretext for that war, the 9/11 incident, how it was manufactured and used to justify the invasions of Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Somalia, and Libya. So hopefully we'll have a good turnout and we'll remind people of what it was about Graham McQueen that endeared him to so many people in the peace movement in Canada.
Well, it's been 22 years in a couple of days' time next week since that terrible event in 2001, and it's been terrible, as you mentioned, multiplied many, many, many times over with the death and destruction wrecked across the world by the United States and its allies, and Canada being one of, well, boasting to be one of the closest allies of the United States in policy and practice, especially when it came to the destruction of Libya, the most the wealthiest of the African nations, now reduced as the saying goes, the Stone Age, with slave markets and all the rest often touted, and another big reversal in any movement towards setting up civic society there just last week or the week before, if I recall rightly.
Yes, there were demonstrations in Libya because the official Libyan government, which is backed by the West, tried to open negotiations to recognize the state of Israel, at which time people took to the streets in Libya because they wanted no part of a rapprochement with the apartheid regime in Tel Aviv.
Yeah, and the regime that bombs almost daily, it seems, or at least a couple times a week, its neighbor Syria. Well, the world premiere of Peace, War, and 9/11, it sounds like a great film. You can see it at the International Center for 9/11 Justice. Am I getting this right?
No.
Is there such a place?
The premiere is Wednesday, September 6th, at 7 p.m. at the Westdale Theater, an old cinema that's been renovated beautifully in West Hamilton. And that will be next week, a week today.
And that's 1014 King Street West, Hamilton, 9:30 Eastern, 9:30 p.m. Wow, that's a late start. Is that right?
No, it starts at 7 p.m. Eastern time.
Oh, 7 to 9:30. Sorry, Ken.
That's okay. It's not a problem. And the tickets are available, and they are, you know, on a sliding scale from $10 to $20 through Eventbrite. And people can get that link just by going to the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War Facebook page. We have a Facebook events page, and people are, you know, joining it.
Yeah, Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. Is that plural, Ken, or singular? I've seen it both. It's singular, yeah. Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War.
We started the coalition in 2002 in the run-up to the war, to the Anglo-American attack on Iraq. And conveniently, we haven't had to change the name of the coalition because there's been a permanent war ever since.
Yeah, maybe you could change it to that, the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the Permanent War or the Forever War, or Generational War, as George W. Bush promised.
Well, you know, I'll take that to the executive.
Yeah, well, I don't want to throw a monkey wrench into anything. But the other hat, of course, that you wear is with the Syria Support Movement International. Okay, now we started with Syria, and I started getting these disturbing reports about demonstrations in the south of the country, and it was the language coming through the media, the Guardian especially, Britain's Guardian newspaper or online presence. It started sounding really eerily similar to 2011 and the so-called color revolutions. I don't know that people here, Ken, or people in our audience know much about the Syrian uprising in 2011, a peaceful uprising, as it was called in the demonstrations. The character of it wasn't exactly as advertised. Do you want to spend a minute just talking about what happened in 2011 and why a resurgence of that is something to be dreaded?
Absolutely. What happened in 2011 was the culmination of U.S. efforts for regime change in Syria, which started, according to WikiLeaks, with who published cables from Damascus to Washington and back and forth, since 2006. So in starting in 2006, because the U.S. Demanded that Bashar al-Assad drop his alliance with Iran and Russia and join the IMF and become part of the West, his refusal to do so precipitated the regime change war that started in 2011. And it was no peaceful uprising. It was, from the very start, the importation, the insertion of terrorist militants from Al-Qaeda and from the Muslim Brotherhood, who had been brought to Syria by the U.S., the U.K., and Israel. And they were armed to the teeth, and they were given a blanket positive coverage in the West as freedom fighters and blah, 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 all the usual stuff about how they were going to bring down a dictator, et cetera, et cetera. Well, it was in the so-called peaceful demonstrations, the U.S. and its allies inserted marksmen or snipers who shot people on both sides in order to create a confrontation and a bloody mess, which did erupt as a result. They used the same tactics in the Maidan in Kiev in 2014, which was documented well by Dr. Ivan Kachanowski of the University of Ottawa. And it's also been documented the same tactics were used to try and overthrow Chavez in Venezuela back in 2002, I believe. And that was documented in a film called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. So that's what happened in Syria, especially in the south around Deraa. These terrorist mercenaries moved in fully armed in groups of 1,000, 1,500, And there was maybe 100 of such groups, and they seized whole chunks of Syrian territory. They stripped everything bare that wasn't nailed down, and even some of the stuff that was nailed down. They forced loyal Syrians to flee their homes and to flee the country. They killed millions, they killed hundreds of thousands of people. It's now estimated that 600,000 people have been killed in this regime change war so far. And they laid waste to whole cities like Homs. And so that war has lasted now 12 years. And the Syrian government, along with its Russian allies and its Iranian allies, its allies from Hezbollah in Lebanon, managed to defeat Al-Qaeda in its franchise in Syria called Al-Nusra, and under a bunch of other names. They defeated ISIS, and they restored the Syrian government's control over a good chunk of the country. There are three parts of the country that are still being held and occupied illegally by the U.S. in the east of the Euphrates. It's occupying illegally the eastern third of Syria, where they pillage the Syrian oil and agricultural resources. The Turks are occupying a buffer zone along the northern frontier, an armed buffer zone. And in the northwest, the Al-Qaeda is still in power in one province only, and that's in Idlib. So we thought, you know, naively that the war was winding down. But now, lately, the U.S. is doubling down on its regime change operation after all these years, and they are still they are ramping up their support for Al Qaeda in the in Idlib by trying to sanitize its leader, a guy named Mohammed Jolani, as a prospective leader for all of Syria, in the same way that they tried with Juan Guaido in Venezuela. It's pathetic, but that's what they try and do. They are also they've also refurbished a big U.S. base in central east Syria to give us a signal that they are have no intention of abandoning their illegal occupation of Syria's wheat fields and oil fields. And they have the U.S. has also, among other things, increased the number of ISIS fighters in the Syrian desert and at a base, a U.S. base called Al-Tanf, which is right on the Jordanian-Syrian border, where they where the Russians and the Syrians have been bombing these terrorist encampments around the U.S. base. And on top of all that, at a critical point in the sanctions campaign, and that's a whole other thing which we've discussed many times, Chris, the U.S., the EU, and Canada was the hub for the international regime of sanctions against Syria. It started in June 1st, 2013, with a meeting of EU and NATO leaders in Ottawa, and they set up the first set of international sanctions against Syria, which impoverished Syria, created huge-scale unemployment, destroyed the currency in Syria, the Syrian pound, and forced literally several million people, could be 4 or 5 million people now, to flee Syrians, to flee Syria and become refugees in Lebanon, Turkey, and other parts way up into Germany. So on top of those sanctions, the U.S. lately, in the last couple of years, introduced more serious, an added layer of sanctions on Syria called the Caesar sanctions, and they applied them to Lebanon as well. Lebanon was acted as the main trading partner of Syria and the port of Syria, and they have basically destroyed the U.S. has basically destroyed with these sanctions the economy of Lebanon and the economy of Syria, And in the last weeks, the Syrian government, which is under considerable pressure now that the Syrian pound is down to about a couple of hundredth TH of its pre-war value, the Syrian government removed the general subsidy on fuel for all Syrians, which they had maintained. And they could do that before the war because they had their own fuel petroleum fields. But they don't now. Those are being held by the Americans in order that Syria cannot reconstruct itself, and so that the Americans will have a say in the final peace talks. And so the Syrian government, without much preparation of the people in Syria, they didn't have a good communications campaign, as I'm told. What they did was they removed the general subsidy on fuel for all Syrians and instead applied a larger subsidy to people according to their income, so that the people who are suffering the most in Syria, and by the way, 90% of Syrians are now living below the poverty line without continuous electricity, petrol, or food. So the government tried to increase the subsidy for fuel to the lowest income Syrians. And what happened was there were demonstrations across the country. The Syrian government did not remove the subsidies on food for Syrians, but they did remove that partial subsidy. And there were demonstrations in many parts of the country, including in the south, where the regime change operation started in 2011. And there were demonstrations with the opposition three-star flag instead of the two-star official flag. And people were using the same eerie slogans from about freedom and democracy, which, of course, al-Qaeda has nothing to do with, and neither does the Muslim Brotherhood or other terrorists. They used the same slogans on posters from 2011. And so it was like deja vu for many people. And it's really unfortunate that this is taking place. But this is the purpose of the sanctions. This is the purpose of this illegal act of war, where you try and you put a siege, an economic blockade, or formerly called coercive economic measures, unilaterally against international law, because they don't have the support of the UN Security Council. You put them on a country, on more than one country. Actually, the US has them on 40 countries. Canada has them on 20. And you try and starve the people to death so that they go out and demonstrate and call for the overthrow of governments which are not compliant to the West. And that's exactly what we are witnessing today in Syria.
Well, and we saw it in Iraq under the Clinton administration in the 90s, too, where this process really cut its teeth and honed its strategies. It used to be called the strategy of tension, if I recall. And now it seems like a strategy now of desperation, something that the people in Palestine, occupied Palestine, know all too well. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Ken Stone. Ken's with the Syria Support Movement International and Hamilton Coalition to Stop the Wars. We're talking today about what looks to be a new color revolution in the offing, strategies going on against Syria, renewed by the United States and its allies, Israel, and even Turkey. It seems to be helping in the north, as you mentioned as well. And I sent along earlier today an excellent overview by Vanessa Belia. She's a British journalist who has lived in Syria for many years, and she was appearing on the show Redacted on YouTube. I know you watched it, Ken. She mentions or at least they begin that interview by talking about Republican representatives, three of them, crossing the border from Turkey illegally. If law means anything when it comes to these things, from Turkey through terrorist-held territory, turf that is held by ISIS and al-Qaeda offshoots or rebranded, but going through this territory is deemed in the United States itself as being an illegal action. What does this say to you, Ken, to see representatives spending their weekend going down into traveling in this way into Syria?
Well, it's a violation of international law. They have entered the country illegally into a part held by terrorists, open terrorists who are affiliated to Al-Qaeda and to, in some ways, to ISIS as well. But the United States considers itself, like Israel, to be an exceptional country. That is to say, they don't have to pay any attention to international law. And the same thing happened eerily in 2011 when the late Senator John McCain entered Syria illegally as well. And he met with leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Free Syrian Army, Al-Qaeda, and all, and the guy who later became or leaders that later became ISIS. So this is nothing new for the United States. They do this on a regular basis. McCain also went to the Maidan in 2014, and so did Victoria Nuland, and she handed out cookies. And our former defense minister, whose name slips my tongue right now, went to the Maidan as well. This is part of the regime change script that Western countries affiliated to NATO and the EU do when they're trying to remove a government that is not compliant to their policies.
Well, Beely also mentions in that video resolution, United Nations Resolution 2245, that they describe, she and her interlocutor, as when you strip out the niceties in the language, it essentially calls for regime change. This is from the United Nations, that body that is supposedly in charge of enforcing or at least promoting international law.
Well, I think I may be wrong, but I think it's Resolution 2254, but that doesn't change it. Yes, she's right. It was a regime change resolution, but all these resolutions to censure and delegitimize the legitimate government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria have failed for two reasons. Number one, Syria has powerful allies at the United Nations Security Council in China and Russia, who veto all these resolutions to try and overthrow the government of Syria in exactly the same manner that they overthrew the government of Libya. And the second reason is that the government of Syria is extremely popular among Syrians. And that's because it is a government, it is a secular government that allows freedom of religion. So all the various sects in Syria, which is a very multicultural country, very much like Canada, where people speak different languages and have different religions and different ethnic backgrounds, they all support the Syrian government because it allows them their freedom of religion and their freedom to practice their ethnic traditions. And it's, in addition to all that, the Syrian government is an Arab socialist government, which had or has or at least had, I don't know under these circumstances today, free medical care for everyone and free education right up to the post-secondary level. So it was a popular government. And Bashar al-Assad has run two elections so far since the illegal regime change attempt on his government. And he's won handily massive victories at the polls, and so has the Syrian parliament. And I went for the parliamentary elections in 2016, and the Syrian parliament is also very popular. So, they're trying to beat Gaddafi in Libya because Libya was not supported. The Libyan government was unfortunately not supported by Russia and China at the UN Security Council. They were caught flat-footed in those days, unfortunately, and because Libya did not have a standing army. But Syria has a strong standing army. And it is very supportive of the government, and it has made huge sacrifices in order to retake the country. So I don't think that these demonstrations that we've seen in the last few weeks are going to bring about a regime change. But it shows how hungry and desperate the poor people of Syria are getting that after 12 years of war, a minority, a small minority, I should point out, is in the streets. There have been demonstrations in support of the government, which are 10, 20 times the size of these little demonstrations. So in my view, the Syrian government will continue, but it's getting very, very tough to live in Syria today.
Well, talk about desperation. Just one look at President Emmanuel Macron of France really reveals a man in desperate straits. We've only got like a minute left, Ken. What's your overview or your just immediate take on the government's falling domino style to popular coups or military coups that seem to be popular in Africa, Gabon falling just today?
Well, I was hoping we would get around to talk about the war in Ukraine, because the war in Ukraine is connected to the war in Syria. It's also connected to all the overthrows of pro-French and pro-EU governments in the Sahel, in the belt of Africa, south of the Sahara. And these changes in government, coups that have taken place and regime changes in the Sahel are directly related to the war in Ukraine, because because the people in Africa realize that the war in Ukraine has created a change in the balance of power, and that the U.S. is not the only, and the EU are not the only games in town. Now there is a multipolar world developing with Russia and China and BRICS at the head of it. And people in the global south have a choice. They can continue to be slaves to France, for example, in Central Africa, where the roads aren't paved, but in Niger, for example, but all the uranium and gold from Niger goes to France. But the roads in Niger are not paved and the people are starving. This is a sign of the changing times in the world, the change in the balance of power as a result of the war in Ukraine. And I wanted to talk, if we had time, about the upcoming global mobilization against that war, which is going to take place in Canada and around the world during the first week of October.
Well, Ken, just hold on a second. I'm going to reiterate where we began, the world premiere of Peace, War, and 9/11 that features and is dedicated to the late Dr. Graham McQueen. And to get it proper for the people in Hamilton, you can go, you can get your tickets at Eventbrite, and you can go Wednesday, September 6th at 7 p.m., 1014 King Street West, the Westdale refurbished beautifully theater. That's 1014 King Street West in Hamilton, Wednesday, September 6th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. And I suppose, Ken, that film might be made available more broadly through, I don't know, online or in some other way at some time in the future. Now, Ken, I want to thank you for coming on and doing this segment with me. I want to also thank Joe Foy of the Wilderness Committee, and we'll end our segment here. If you want to continue for a longer segment, as you mentioned, Ken, I'm happy to do it. Do you want to continue on for a longer version?
Yes, I am. I would like to talk about the war in Ukraine and what the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network, of which I'm a coordinating committee member, is planning to do.
Okay, let's do that then. But for the rest of you, you'll have to find that at the website, guerrilla-radio.com. I'm also up at Substack as well, and other places too. When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favorite uncle that's taken you for walks in the park, however, that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday.
Every day, residents of Vancouver use an average of 270 liters of water in their daily lives. While this number may seem impossible, every drop counts. For example, the tap water you left on while brushing your teeth, or that load of laundry consisting of only one t-shirt. And don't forget the time you sang Don't Stop Believin' for 45 minutes in the shower. Wasting water is something we're all guilty of. So next time, let's turn the water off when brushing our teeth. Make sure that load of laundry we're washing is full, and limit our showers to under 10 minutes. Let's limit our water consumption one task at a time. brought to you by the City of Vancouver.